Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In this lecture, recorded on September 3rd, 2017, at the National Gallery of Art, Richard I. Schuchensky discusses his book, Projections of Memory, Romanticism, Modernism, and the Aesthetics of Film, an exploration of innovative cinematic works that use their extraordinary scope to construct monuments to the imagination through which currents from the other arts can flow. By examining these works, Projections of Memory remaps film history around some of its most ambitious achievements and helps to clarify cinema as a 20th century art form. Schuchensky addresses some of the core concerns of the book through a discussion of films by Andrei Tarkovsky, Béla Tarr, and Jean-Luc Godard, alongside paintings by Caspar David Friedrich, Jacopo Tintoretto, and Matthias Grunewald.
The title of this talk, as was mentioned, is the same as the title of my most recent book, which focused on the relationship between Romanticism and Modernism, the nature of the film experience, and the transformation of artistic forms across periods and media. In particular, I am interested in the stubborn persistence of tradition within and between moments of historical cataclysm and movements, including some prominent strands of both Romanticism and Modernism, marked by seeming iconoclasm. I would like to begin today by looking at two film stills that explicitly attempt to synthesize different artistic currents and are emblematic of the book's central concerns. The first is the final composite image from Andrei Tarkovsky's Nostalgia. At the 1983 Telluride Film Festival, Stan Brakhage presented a medal to Tarkovsky, declaring that he was the world's greatest living narrative filmmaker because he deeply understood the three essential tasks for cinema in the 20th century. Brakhage defined these as make the epic, keep it personal, because only in the eccentricities of our personal lives do we have any chance at the truth, and do the dream work. The film that Tarkovsky had brought with him to the festival, Nostalgia, does all of these things, bringing itself firmly within the Western cultural tradition through open citations of landmarks of painting. So here's Piero della Francesca's Madonna del Prato. Sculpture, among others, this is the equestrian statue of Marcus Aurelius in the center of Rome. Architecture and music. All of these are filtered through the perspective of an outsider, the protagonist Andrei Gorchakov, a Russian scholar and a surrogate for the Soviet filmmaker, who elected to remain in exile while shooting in Italy. The film culminates in a final image that is saturated with multiple levels of nostalgia for the homeland that has been abandoned, signified by a Russian dacha, for the values attached to the artworks included in the film, and for an elevated conception of art making that is at odds with the priorities of modern life, all mediated by a treatment of the natural sublime derived from German Romanticism and framed by the ruins of a cathedral. And Tarkovsky is here fusing together elements from two paintings by Caspar David Friedrich. The top half of the image comes at least partially from this image, and the bottom half comes from this memorial to Ulrich von Hutten. And note, in both cases, here we actually have an open-air memorial space, and here we have refulgent nature dominating, overwhelming the man-made structures. Both of those are present here as well. So inside this cathedral, we not only have the dacha, we have these trees. With this ambivalent ending, Tarkovsky implicitly portrays cinema as a medium uniquely capable of containing the essences of all the other arts. It is therefore highly appropriate that the protagonist is shown resting inside the exposed nave of a cathedral, a central romantic motif whose literary locus is Victor Hugo's 1831 novel, Notre Dame de Paris, which includes a long discussion of the cathedral's role as embodiment of artistic and cultural values and the ways in which that status is challenged by new technologies, such as the printing press. This image itself becomes a new reference point, ironically transformed by later filmmakers such as Bela Tarr in his 8-hour anti-epic Satan Tango, who gives it very different associations. Where Friedrich suggests the overwhelming power of nature, and Tarkovsky attempts to represent a sort of spiritual sublimation into art, Tarr connects these ruins to suicide, this is midway through the film, and madness, this is right near the end of the film. Nevertheless, these melancholic negations testify to the strength and durability of a tradition they extend. The second image is a still from Scénario du film Pêchon, a video essay by Jean-Luc Godard released in 1982. Here we see a fusion of other romantic motifs, of aspirations and yearnings embodied by the superimposition of a painting, Tintoretto's 1578, The Marriage of Bacchus and Ariadne, on a silhouette of Godard with hands outstretched like a demiurge. There are a whole series of overlapping associations here that resonate with Godard's position and practice. The tactility of Tintoretto's painting style and his sensuous depiction of bodies, his status as both the end of a line of Venetian painting and someone who made innovative use of the artistic resources and technologies of his age to push his aesthetic further, and his plastic facility and complex relationship to tradition. Godard himself suggests in the video that the painting resonates with the subject of his own film, Passion, for which this is a video sketch. One man and two women, and the idea of a sacred trinity. Significantly, the great art historian Ilefort had discussed Tintoretto as a proto-cinematic figure due to his symphonic movement, emphasis on flux, and whirlwinds of color in the Renaissance art section of his multi-volume History of Art. That is a key reference point for Godard's cathedral-like 4.5-hour epic, Histoires du Cinéma, 1988 to 1998, an 8-part video work that is divided into paired sections entitled 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B, etc. Deeply concerned with the impact of the projected image, Godard's magnum opus gives new meaning to an aesthetic of fragments, using a dense network of associations to meditate on the end of the 20th century and its preeminent creative medium, the cinema. As the retrospective tenor of Godard's late work acutely demonstrates, the influence of romanticism on these filmmakers is also evident in their treatment of memory. Since the publication of John Locke's An Essay Concerning Human Understanding in 1689, the impression of continuity established by and within memory has been understood to be the fundamental precondition of individual selfhood. Rebutting the mechanistic assumptions of the Enlightenment, the early Romantics emphasized the vitality of memory, drawing attention to its ability to both give coherence to and to creatively transform discrete perceptions. Friedrich Schlegel argued that the, quote, concept of unity can by no means be deduced except out of memory. It can no more be explained through the senses than through reason. Like Schlegel, Novalis attempted to distinguish passive recollection from active memory, which he aligned with productive imagination. Samuel Taylor Coleridge developed a similar contrast between fancy and imagination in his Biographia Literaria, 1817, connecting the former, fancy, with the passivity of ordinary memory, and arguing that the latter, imagination, instead, quote, dissolves, diffuses, dissipates, in order to recreate, At all events, it struggles to idealize and to unify. The fixed structure of film projection, with reels of printed film frames unspooling sequentially, is even more rigidly iterative than that of the mind. One of the goals of the projects discussed in Projections of Memory is to involve the active memory of the viewer and encourage heightened engagement through structures of parallelism and contrast, the frequent mnemonic return to particular tropes or figures, and the exploration of the complex interrelationship between subjective experience and collective histories. Approximately 1 minute before the end of the final section, The Signs Among Us, 4B, of Histoires du Cinéma, the inimitable voice of Ezra Pound appears on the soundtrack, reading a section from the first of his cantos. This is the first time either Pound or Elpenor had been mentioned, and no immediate explanation is given for the inclusion of this excerpt, which is accompanied by a clip from Orson Welles' Othello, 1952, and preceded by four images linked together by cuts and superimpositions. Taken as discrete units, none of these seemingly unrelated and unlabeled images, a close-up of a man's eye from Mr. Arkadin, Orson Welles, 1955, a still of a human eye about to be spliced from Un Chien Andalou, a shot of an editor cutting a strip of film, and a shot of Godard in profile, both taken from JLG, JLG, Self-Portrait in December, 1994, helps to elucidate the enigmatic text. Viewed as elements of an elaborate audiovisual montage chain, however, they suggest that Pound's carefully enunciated words could be indirectly linked to the structure of filmmaking and to Godard's project. Like Godard, Pound is invested in stitching together different ideas and periods. Using the spectral encounter between Odysseus and his dead friend Elpenor to reflect upon the way in which the ghosts of the past endure into the present, as manifested through a language that is informed by historical experience. After all, as Pound makes clear at the end of the canto, his words are a translation of the Odyssey, rendered according to the conventions of Old English verse. Godard's mode of quotation throughout Histoires du Cinéma is similarly aggregate, intermixing images, sounds, and texts, stripped from their original context and reintegrated into a new matrix. Godard's repositioning of the Pound extract makes it too resonate with larger ideas of cinema, connecting Elpenor, the forgotten friend of Odysseus who died unwept, unburied, and begs to be remembered, to his elegiac lament for his medium, not through simplistic metaphor, but through a dense weave of implied associations that steadily accumulate gravity, even as they resist fixed, unitary meaning. As always, there is a danger of making Godard's montages cohere too easily as text, when the point is to create audiovisual relationships that extend out in multiple directions at once, much like the use of recurring motifs in the work of directors like Erich von Stroheim. In Histoires du Cinéma, repeated images, sounds, or sequences function as modernist metacommunication, a way of putting Godard's films in dialogue with both one another and with the history of the arts. For example, Rubens' Portrait of Susanna Formant, 1622 to 1625, is used throughout Godard's late work, appearing in Fatal Beauty, 2B, JLG, JLG, The Old Place, 1999, which was a commission from MoMA, In Praise of Love, 2001, here it is on the wall, and Notre Musique, 2004. In each of the later iterations, the appearance of this Rubens painting recalls its use in the earlier films, while also functioning as cinematic shorthand, condensing Godard's arguments about the tendency for male artists to frame women, quote, from the bust into a single image. This is the pictorial equivalent of Godard's frequent musical quotations. And in at least one instance, the use in Histoires du Cinéma of Paul Hindemith's symphony, Matthias de Mahler, 1934, and Matthias Grunewald's Isenheim altarpiece, 1512 to 1515, the two streams are powerfully interrelated. The crucifixion on the front of Grunewald's famous polyptych, designed for a hospital chapel run by Antonine monks, devoted to easing the suffering from gangrenous disease, includes an image of St. John the Baptist pointing towards the body of Christ. Next to his hand, a Latin phrase reading, "He must increase, but I must decrease," John 3:30, is inscribed on the surface of the painting. In order to reinforce the lesson contained in this text, Grunewald disregards the conventions of just proportion developed during the Renaissance, making the suffering Christ dominate in the manner of sacred images developed before the advent of linear perspective. The painting's visual structure suggests a strong reassertion of Catholic faith, but its unusual and iconographically unnecessary reliance on text has made it central to later Protestant arguments about visual representation. Karl Barth kept a reproduction by his desk throughout his career and excluded it from his more general condemnation of images, while Paul Tillich went so far as to claim that it is the, quote, greatest German picture ever painted. In Histoires du Cinéma and several other films, Godard crops Grunewald's frontispiece to emphasize the figure of St. John the Baptist and the inscription, using it as a totem for the conflict between text and images in his films. So I'll come back to this one. This is from Histoires du Cinéma. You'll actually see this clip. Here is the same image of St. John the Baptist in Notre Musique, further cropped to elide the inscription and draw attention to the book. And here it is in Origins of the 21st Century from 2001. There has always been a tension between the visual and textual modalities of Godard's work that was given greater philosophical and theological significance in the 1980s and 1990s. The years surrounding the creation of Histoires du Cinéma. The writings Godard uses matter a great deal to his work, but what he objects to is the way in which printed words can become rigid, even oppressive, models of authority. As with many aspects of Godard's work in this period, there are echoes of St. Paul, "For the letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life," from 2 Corinthians. By extracting phrases from their sources, without, it should be noted, making it impossible to trace their origins, and putting them in dialogue with other audiovisual or textual materials, Godard makes them part of an active and dynamic process and keeps them from solidifying into text. It is the irreducible polyvalence of images that underlies Godard's strong preference for the silent cinema. Here's a quote. "With silence, there was no need to talk in order to be understood. It was the speech of silence. Then, with the coming of sound, the text, the scenario, returned to power. At the moment when Stalin became Stalin, Hitler Hitler, the scenario, the text, the programs, the scenarios, and the camps." These same concerns informed Paul Hindemith's Matthias de Mahler, a musical response to the Isenheim altarpiece that is one of the most frequently excerpted pieces of music in Histoires du Cinéma and Godard's late work more generally. In addition to Protestant sympathies, Grunewald is also said to have supported the peasants in the Peasants' War of 1524 to 1525, and Hindemith draws parallels to the contemporary political situation in Nazi Germany in his symphonic and operatic portraits. Throughout Histoires du Cinéma, Godard uses extracts from the third movement of the symphony as sonic counterparts to the visual allusions to the Isenheim altarpiece, reflexively emphasizing the formation of a synthetic montage image by focusing on a section at the beginning of the movement that attempts to musically represent the moment of artistic creation. This is the beginning of the third movement of Matthias der Mahler. In the clip you just saw, the cropped image of St. John the Baptist appears in superimposition with the words that are the title of the work, Histoires du Cinéma. Shortly before this extract from Matthias der Mahler, which is dedicated to the temptation of St. Anthony, is used. Grunewald's depiction of one of these temptations, in which St. Anthony is beaten to death by demons in a cave, revived, and then beset once again by the same demons before a sudden flash causes them to flee, had appeared several moments before. Superimposed with El Greco's Christ throwing traitors from the temple, 1600, this is the version of the painting that's used in the film, it's the one in the National Gallery in London. It visually encapsulates the narrative of death and rebirth developed in Histoires du Cinéma. Cropped and partially veiled by superimposition, however, it is as concealed within the audiovisual fabric of Histoires du Cinéma as Grunewald's rendering of the scene, visible only when the altarpiece is fully open, is buried inside its architectural frame. So here is what the Isenheim altarpiece looks like in the second stage when you move the outer wings. And when you move the inner wings, you see these two panels. And all of the images that are being pulled from the Temptation of St. Anthony panel are on the right, in particular these demons over here. And in a moment, we'll see these demons over here. So the demons that are besetting, attacking St. Anthony until he's rescued by a flash of light. Godard proves himself here to be an ardent follower of Robert Bresson's maxim: hide the ideas, but so that people find them. The most important will be the most hidden. What Godard is suggesting is that the historical rebirth brought about by neorealism is a kind of resurrection, the revitalization of an approach to cinematic image making that was first consigned to a passive role by sound and then compromised further by World War II. This type of cinema offers something to the viewer, a secular faith that the post-war generation, steeped in Sartrean ideas of commitment, could believe in. Godard's voiceover is accompanied by a complex montage, and the triple repetition of the phrase, "the cinema like Christianity," creates the impression that the film is caught in the projector, a conceptual stutter that is overcome only when Godard continues in French, quote, "It offers us a historical narrative and says, now believe, but not believe this narrative with the belief appropriate to a historical narrative. Rather, believe through thick and thin, which you can only do as the result of life. Here you have a narrative, don't take the same attitude to it as you take to other historical narratives. The source, a 1937 note from Ludwig Wittgenstein, becomes clearer when Godard repeats the last phrase in German and then reads the final sentence, "Make a quite different place in your life for it," in both French and German. After using these linguistic shifts to invoke the post-Babel confusions of speech, the screen goes black and an excerpt from the soundtrack of Fritz Lang's Im, 1931, is intertwined with the beginning of the third movement of Hindemith's Matiste Mahler. In the text Godard quotes from, Wittgenstein is addressing the structural significance of faith in Christian belief, ideas that Godard explicitly analogizes to the relationship between viewer and screen in the cinema. Even here, however, the montage remains destabilizing and paradoxical, with the audio excerpt from Im continuing over an image of an emaciated hand from a 1947 Alberto Giacometti sculpture, strongly evoking yet again the irredeemable atrocities of World War II. In what follows, however, Godard makes his strongest audiovisual argument for the power of the cinema in the post-war world. The Giacometti hand is linked via dissolve to a still image of Joan of Arc's hand on the floor in Bresson's The Trial of Joan of Arc, 1962. Although it is one of Bresson's least known films, Godard returns to The Trial of Joan of Arc more than any other, using its spare concentration of gesture and portrayal of Joan to stand in for the martyrdom of an art form besieged by institutions that constrain its spiritual power. Godard superimposes text with the still, beginning an extended punning dialogue in which he alludes to a frequently used paraphrase from St. Paul. "Will come" appears over the Trial of Joan of Arc image, followed by an image of a hand preparing to take communion. This is a characteristic Godardian pun, au temps, the O working multiple ways at the same time. An image of the couple from The Story of the Flaming Years by Yulia Solzneva, 1961. An image of Johannes and Marin from The End of Ordet, Carl Dreyer, 1955. A photograph of an empty bed with the imprint of a body from Psycho. And finally, a moving shot from Un Chien Andalou, ending just before the eye is sliced. The image will come at the time of the resurrection. And I should add in passing here, this doesn't actually come from any of St. Paul's writings. This is a condensation, a reworking of a number of different passages, mainly from 1 Corinthians, that Godard is using for his own purposes. But nevertheless, the idea is a reworking of certain eschatological notions developed by St. Paul. This short excerpt is as densely packed as the rest of Histoires du Cinéma. But coming immediately after the Wittgenstein text, at least one strong thread appears. What the cinema alone, through the montage-driven transformation of conventional vision, can do is summon an image of that which exceeds the boundaries of sight. Whatever iconic purity it may have had in an earlier period, this image is perpetually in flux, its plenitude accessible only through the matrix of contrapuntal collisions on which its visibility depends. In The Control of the Universe, 4A, Godard refers to Ordet as one of only two films in the history of cinema that successfully presented a miracle. And the shot he selects in this sequence is of the moment before Johannes raises his sister-in-law from the dead. Unlike Dreyer, Godard leaves the definitive moment off-screen, instead using associational montage to hint at transformational potentialities that remain within Histoires du Cinéma unfulfilled. For me, montage is the resurrection of life, Godard declared in an interview. It is the sense of utopia, of possible resurrection, that I have found in montage, which means that if I am alone, it is a shame, but it is bearable. This is exactly what we see in the following sequence from Germany, year 1991, an exploration of post-unification Germany that functions as a pendant to the then ongoing Histoires du Cinéma project. In a 2001 interview with Alexander Kluge, Godard described the biographical significance of the film, which seems to have brought his allegiances to German Romanticism to the fore. Here's Godard. With Germany year 1990, I came to terms with my youth. As a young man, I discovered the German Romantics. I even read books that people don't read anymore. The German Romantics moved something in me, more than the French did. In a way, I think I paid a debt I owed to Germany by making that film. In the clip we just saw, there is a characteristically dense layering of visual, textual, and musical references. A page from Kafka's The Castle, Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet, text reading End of Germany, the phrase Death and Transfiguration as both a philosophical meditation and the title of an important piece by Richard Strauss, etc. But I want to focus on the elements taken from Grunewald. At the beginning of the sequence, we have a book. This is Grimmelshausen's famous Baroque picaresque novel. And on the cover, we find the demons from the Temptations of St. Anthony panel of the Isenheim altarpiece. They're right here, the ones we saw before. And I'm certain there is no such edition of this book. This is a Godardian collage constructed for the film. Then we have a reflection on light, filtering through windows and reflecting on surfaces as a metaphor for both the essence of the photographic or film image and for consciousness that is explicitly linked to a discussion of religious practice and to a crucifixion image from another Grunewald altarpiece. Finally, at the end of the sequence, the demons from the other side of the Temptation of St. Anthony panel appear, these ones. So they're over here. Here's St. Anthony, as I said, attacked on both sides. One of many stand-ins for the idea of art, of cinema, of a certain type of aesthetic purity. And we've seen at the beginning of the sequence these demons, and at the end of the sequence these demons. Everything in this montage sequence, the meditation on German history, the cataclysms of the Second World War, and on light, is bracketed by these parallel fragments from the Isenheim altarpiece. Histoires du Cinéma goes even further than Germany year 1990 in presenting cinema as both a site of dubious escapism and a ritual act, transforming the ephemerality of a medium predicated on mass reproducibility into an audiovisual monument with some of the structural weight and embedded cultural memory of a cathedral. Watched as an intensive unit, there is a gradual feeling of developing assent to Histoires du Cinéma, with the fugal repetitions intermittently evoking the sensation of rapture, momentary glimpses of transcendent release that are inextricable from the constant reminders of the 20th century's horrors. Godard's claim that the best way to watch Histoires du Cinéma is to, quote, enter into the image without a name or a reference in mind, suggests that the ideal viewer will take in the layers of reference in much the same way that a cathedral visitor absorbs the pedagogical program of stained glass windows elevated far above eye level through the diffusion of light. Yet F. Histoire du Cinéma can be seen as a cathedral-like work. It is also an echo chamber, a labyrinth of the mind, which language is able to penetrate only in the most halting way. The many repetitions, half starts, and pauses reflect not only Godard's resistance to historiographic transparency, but also the deliberately unstable positioning of his own authorial interventions. Godard provides one possible explanation when anticipated by a single on-screen definition of cinema as time lost and time found in The Cinema Alone, 2A. He cries out, "Albertine," at the beginning of Fatal Beauty, 2B. This allusion to Marcel Proust's masterwork announces early in Histoires du Cinéma that it is, on at least one level, a fictionalized autobiography, Histoires du Cinéma, an extended memory piece permeated with associations that are at once hermetically private, and profoundly interlinked. Late in JLG, JLG, a 1994 film that Godard intended to have presented in conjunction with Histoires du Cinéma, he offers up a sort of indirect Ars Poetica by having a blind seer recite the final passages of Ovid's Metamorphoses in Latin. Substituting America for Rome in the manner of quotations in Histoires du Cinéma, Godard translates the words into French and significantly analogizes his work to that of a poet. This is Godard translating on the left. "And now the work is done, that Jupiter's anger, fire, or sword cannot erase, nor the gnawing tooth of time. Let that day that only has power over my body end, when it will, my uncertain span of years. Yet the best part of me will be born immortal beyond the distant stars. Wherever America, Rome's, influence extends, over the lands it has civilized, I will be spoken. And famous through all the ages, if there is truth in poets' prophecies, I shall live." Godard's decision to invoke this heritage in his apologia testifies to its role in his thinking at this time. There were no extended texts quoted in Latin in the films made before Histoires du Cinéma was initiated. And it helps to explain his decision to structure his long-form epic as a mythic journey led by a fictionalized self-projection of the author. After all, the very first words to appear on screen, and this is before we see anything, are "hoc opus hic labor est." That's the trouble, that's the task. A passage from the Aeneid that refers to the difficulties of returning from hell. The passage from Pound at the very end of The Signs Among Us, 4b, returns to this imagery, which, like the underworld scene in the Aeneid, derives from the Nequia in Book 11 of the Odyssey. As in Histoires du Cinéma, Pound returns again and again to central figures, looping back to remind the reader of the spiraling arc of the Chris Elephantine work. Thus, in one of the last Pis on Kontos, 83, the reader encounters Tiresias Deba, the same Tiresias Theban who had prophesied in the passage that begins just after the one used in the first clip I showed you today, that Odysseus would, quote, "come to disaster, losing all companions." Equivalent recurring motifs could be found throughout both Histoires du Cinéma and the Cantos, but this one is especially significant because it represents a return to the beginning and because it underscores the centrality of the Odyssean quest, which ends in near total isolation. "You in the dinghy, Picciolette, astern there," Pound cries out in Canto 109, evoking yet again the sea journey of Odysseus, while also pointing back to the central model underpinning his modernist poetic epic by explicitly alluding to the third part of Dante's The Divine Comedy. Yet creating a Paradiso has proven to be an insurmountable obstacle for Romantics and for post-Romantics. How can one convincingly depict the perfection of the heavens within an aesthetic framework oriented around ceaseless becoming? Godard, too, has struggled with the problem of endings, and at least since he began Histoires du Cinéma, with the task of completing a cinematic commedia. One of the joys of watching Godard's films, and I mean this with complete sincerity, is seeing the way that these different motifs start to play into one another. They're mutually reinforcing. I mean, he really was someone who thought of cinema in this whole period as an extension of poetry and also as an extension of art history. So some of the motifs I've even brought up in this talk come together here. Both parts of the tracking shot, or the two tracking shots, you can see prominently positioned these two books. What are they? This is Inferno and this is Purgatorio. Your attention is drawn to them by the presence of this lamp. My friend, the great Japanese critic Shigehiko Hasumi, has written very eloquently about Godard as a lamp filmmaker, and he actually brackets the sections of this shot around the lamp. We've seen lamps in many other Godard films as well. Here we have Orson Welles' Othello, the same film that we looked at very early on at the end of The Signs Among Us, 4B, and there's actually a text that shows up on screen that says, The Signs Among Us. So Godard is suggesting, among other things, that this particular passage has interpretive significance for the work as a whole. So he's drawing attention once again to the presence of the Inferno and the Purgatorio, not the Paradiso. And in passing, because I introduced this earlier, we also get our friend the Rubens back here. So here's a reflection on different modes of representation of the female body. You have the Rubens, this beautiful painting by Rembrandt, and then, of course, a photographic cinematic representation of the woman working in Godard's studio, or at least acting as someone who's cleaning Godard's studio. In both Nouvelle Vague, 1990, and The Currency of the Absolute, 3A, Godard includes quotations from both Inferno and Purgatorio, but nothing from the Paradiso. Parts of Inferno had earlier been recited and discussed in Contempt, 1963. The one time that Godard attempts to film Paradise, in the third part of the explicitly Dantean Notre Musique, it is circumscribed, bisected by barbed wire, and blocked by American Marines, ironically literalizing the lyrics of the military anthem, "If the Army and the Navy ever look on heaven's scenes, they will find the streets are guarded by United States Marines." This is the Marine Corps anthem, which is emanating from an on-screen radio. So here we have a variation on many of the things that I've been speaking about today, and you bring together aspects of Godard's formal sophistication and his dense layering of references and allusions. So we have two shots, I'm going past the point where people are jumping rope, two shots demonstrating two key stylistic devices of Godard's cinema. Long tracking shots, like the ones we saw of the bookshelves in JLG, JLG, and beautifully composed extended close-ups. We also have two parallel visions of Paradise, a long take in which a man and a woman are able to eat an apple with impunity, and a characteristically unresolved shot-counter-shot exchange that takes us to the limit of cinematic representation. In other words, on the other side of this visual axis is that which cannot be shown. In the text, the recitation that we have there reinforces the same idea. So of course, what do? We cut to black. For Godard, Paradise, like Utopia, is something always anticipated and endlessly deferred. However, an epic video project aspiring to contain the history of cinema needs a conclusion. And Godard wanted to find something that would have an impact after 4.5 hours that it would not have otherwise. his characteristically vertiginous solution is to fuse the different levels of the work: autobiographical, historical, and aesthetic, in a synthesis that enables new forms of regeneration. In this final montage, Godard links a reprocessed image of a yellow rose with a photograph of himself superimposed with Francis Bacon's Study for a Portrait of Vincent van Gogh II, 1957. It's one of a series of six. I believe one of them is actually at the Hirshhorn, very close to here. In artistic response to a Van Gogh canvas destroyed by Allied bombing during the Second World War. Godard tells the story of a man who, quote, passed through paradise in a dream and received a flower as proof of his passage, and found that flower in his hand when he awoke. I was that man. We have romantic egotism in play as well here. The image of the flower is derived from a shot of a white rose in Germany, year 90, where, accompanied by the Sanctus from Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, 1824, it had functioned as an allusion to the anti-Nazi rebel group led by Sophie Scholl, the White Rose, in 1943. Resituated, and with its color changed, however, the image takes on a different meaning, evoking the, quote, yellow of the sempiternal rose that appears at the end of the Paradiso, and implicitly suggesting that Godard's companion, Anne-Marie Mieville, whose name appears for the first time in the dedication to the Signs Among Us, 4b, may have functioned as the Beatrice to Godard's Dante. By moving within the space of 1 minute from the beginning of one epic poem, Pound's Cantos, to the ending of another, the Divine Comedy, Godard constructs a constellation of mutually resonating associations that, pivoting on an image that echoes earlier sections of his own epic, links origins and conclusions, birth and death, together. On-screen text credits the story to Borges, which is where most scholars have left it. But Borges was also a modernist scavenger, and he took the story from Coleridge, who, in turn, had found it in a volume of John Paul's Geist from 1801. For John Paul, the story was an affirmation of an absolute world he desperately wanted to believe in. For Godard, by contrast, the rose is more ambivalent, the symbol of a journey through a paradise that, always lost, hovers in the interstices of history and can only be recovered in memory. Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.